seconds. One time for the underdog. One time for the underdog. Ignition sequence start.
Let me see you put 'em up. Reach the sky, touch the stars up above. Cause it's one time for the underdog. One time for the underdog.
I remember a few years ago when my dad and I went to the movies at Arclight to watch this movie. It was so bad. There was only two seats all the way in the back where everybody makes out. But there was at least 1,000 people at this Arclight theater in Sherman Oaks. And we watched the movie Wolf of Wall Street. And by the time it was done, I mean, this was obviously an insane movie. But by the time it was done, we came home. And the entire time my dad was talking about it. Today, I sit down with him and I talk to him about the movie as well as his thoughts on Bitcoin. We are sitting with the legendary Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing great.
It's good to have you here on Valuetainment. We get a lot of requests about sitting with you. And I was telling you a story early, which I thought was pretty interesting. I used to work at Morgan Stanley Dean Witter the day before 9/11. And I'm in Austin. I'm sitting at the bar having dinner. Wolf of Wall Street had just come out. And this guy's sitting next to me. They're talking. I said, you know, what do you do? He says, I'm an advisor. I'm a financial advisor from New York. I said, you know, is this Wolf of Wall Street story really, like, was there really a guy like this? He says, Pat, it's absolutely true. We all wanted to go to his parties. This guy was epic. It's one side to watch a movie because you see the fiction side. Right. And the other side is to actually sit down and talk to, and hopefully we can get some cool stories here. So here's what I want to talk today. I'm going to talk a little bit about your story.
Sure.
Little bit about sales, not necessarily on the sales, how to sell. I think your strength is not just how to sell. There's a lot of great salespeople. But the sales management side, I kind of want to talk to you about a little bit on who you targeted, who you focused on, who worked good with you, how you got the best out of people. And then maybe a little bit about Bitcoin and, you know, future, the market, and what you think about this. So my first question would be this. I watched Wolf of Wall Street with my pops, okay?
Better than your mom.
We sat in the back, and my dad, I said, he comes, I said, how'd you like the movie? He says, I love the movie. I says, what do you think? I say, you think we should go back and have Jennifer watch it? My wife, he says, nobody from the family should watch it, but this was the best movie I've seen. So he was talking about it. So tell me, you know, forget about the stories in the movie. What actually happened that maybe was a little too crazy to put in a movie? Was there any story didn't make it in the movie?
When I wrote the book back in 2007, there were certain plot lines that got completely edited out because there were some public figures involved and some stuff. I had a lot of political stuff going on too, with senators and Clinton and stuff like that. And that all got...
Clinton?
Yeah, Hillary Clinton. It was a whole big thing. Not directly with Hillary, but with a U.S. senator that she was bucking heads with. And it's a long story. Anyway,
Story you can't get into.
I really can't get into that because, you know...
Hillary Clinton and senators.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, so a U.S. senator who was incredibly... outspoken against her, and they were bucking heads. Anyway, make a long story short.
This is New York.
Yeah, so when I submitted that to the publisher, Random House, they're like, I don't know about that one. So they sort of said, that's going to be a political, you know, hot potato. So I edited that one out. But I think in terms of what people are interested in is those things that happened that were so crazy and insane that simply were just, you know, not fit for public consumption. There was a lot of that stuff, actually. So I mean, I think the one scene that sticks out among all was the bachelor party. So if you read the book, The Wolf of Wall Street, there's only one disconnect in the book. There's a scene where I am getting married and I have 100 brokers call me to Las Vegas and I ship 100 hookers out there as well. And it's just like the most insane situation you can imagine going on. We're at the Mirage Hotel and they sort of depicted that in the movie, but they sort of cut the whole thing out, right? And what happened was I wrote the whole scene, right? It was about eight pages long. And I sent it to my editor, a woman, Daniel Perez, and she'd already read insane stuff. Like, you know, it was already all the dark insanity was there. She read this and she sends it back. She goes, wow, W-O-W, exclamation point. And she goes, I don't think other human beings will understand. I said, well, I know a few humans will understand. She said, I just don't think people will get this scene.
So even more than what you saw in the movie.
Oh my God,
truly.
Not even close. I mean, just it was the
worst. I mean, listen, there was a couple scenes where you watch it, you're kind of uncomfortable. You're like.
No, this was like far worse than anything in the movie by far. I mean, the things that happened at this bachelor party were so depraved that I had to leave. Like, I ended up leaving Vegas. Like, the next morning I got up and we had to get out of there. And I think the thing that the movie does really well, my hat's off to Scorsese, is that he was able to put the life of someone that did a lot of things wrong, did a lot of things really right as well, but clearly made some huge mistakes, but he put it on the screen without judgment. And I think that's what a great director does. What I hate personally, when I go to a movie, I don't want to be told how to feel. I hate when we telegraphs, like, they make it so much like, this is how you should feel, right? And it's almost like a spoon feeding the emotion. Versus he said, okay, here's what happened. You know, it was fun. There's no denying it was fun. It was evil in some ways. It was awesome in some ways. But he's like, I'll put it up there and let everyone have their own opinion of it. And I think that was the magic of the movie, was to be able to, and that's what Scorsese is so great at, is that he just puts characters up there. They could be lovable rogues. Yeah. You know, it's just, it's all about how you feel, interact with the film, versus someone that puts a movie up there and they're telegraphing things. They hate this person, like this person. Yeah. They're moralizing. He didn't moralize. So I think that was the brilliance of the movie. And of course, Leo is just an incredible actor. Leo did a great job. And I think he shocked a lot of people with the physical comedy and stuff, and he was just great. And I think one thing that people don't realize with Leo is he worked really hard on this. It wasn't like he just like, I'm Leo DiCaprio, I'm gonna
so
just...
So talk about that. Was he like asking you questions? What do you do this? What do you think about this?
We spent about 8 to 10 months together. We're just like, all the time.
You've got to be
kidding. Yeah, we're really just constantly being together, meeting and talking things through and speaking on the phone all the time. He was working with a dialect coach and I was working with the coach with him. We worked on all the scenes in the boardroom together. Terrence Winter wrote the script and it was amazing. And I then took the sort of the stock scenes with the sales, and I rewrote those just to make them totally authentic. I don't want to say, Terry's amazing, right? But those scenes were just stock scenes.
Sure.
And Leo was so intent on getting everything authentic. And I think that's really why he was so great in the movies, because he put the time in. And I'm a believer that, you know, with anything that you do, you should put your time
that
in.
That says a lot about him, like how detailed he is.
He's not like, oh, I'm Leo, I'm
yeah,
so great.
That's so impressive.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you, how was Scorsese with this whole process with you?
Very interesting. So Scorsese was very different. Scorsese was like, listen, he fell in love with the whole straight line system, the actual sales side of it. Like, that's what really intrigued him, is that what was really going on, he saw it very quickly, that behind the whole thing was this system I created that allowed average people to become awesome, right? He's such a cinephile, this guy. I had like hundreds of hours of videos. He studied every single video. He knew every single one. He was really into the whole thing. But interestingly enough, he says, listen, he didn't want to spend that much time with me personally, because he goes, I have this vision of you. He goes, and I don't want the real Jordan Belfort to influence how I want this character to appear on the screen.
Isn't that amazing?
So I limited my contact with him at a certain point, and he just put, and then at the end, we spent time together. He was awesome. He gave me a cameo at the end. And
that was cool, though, by the way. When that happened, that was really, really cool.
And, you know, so really, Leo was my conduit to Marty, mostly. Yeah. But it worked well. I mean, and I get it, why he did it. He goes, you know, if you're there, it's like, I have a character I'm creating, and then there's the real guy. I'll be constantly going back and forth, and sort of at a certain point, it becomes counterproductive. So, but at the end, you know, when I sat there and watched the movie, I was like, oh my God.
Were you nervous how the world's gonna view, you know, The Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort?
Not really. I mean, no, I wasn't really
enthusiastic. Like, you can't wait to see it.
At that point, I had met my partner, my wife Anne.
Sure.
And she's amazing. She's the best thing that ever happened.
She's amazing. She's by the way, just the way she welcomed us was amazing.
And I think, you know, having her in my life, when you have a great woman in your life, or a great man if you're a great partner, it just makes you so confident about your own, not about myself, just about, like, I felt really good about everything. It didn't matter what people thought of me. I had the person I loved, I had my children, so it didn't really bother me. And I knew that, you know, when I wrote the book, I knew I put myself out there for public scrutiny.
Yeah.
That I get a lot of detractors. But you know what? I mean, in the end, in the internet, like, I think if Jesus Christ gave a sermon on the Temple Mount, his famous sermon, you'd have people, trolls, there's nothing new there. That's bullshit. He's full. Like, you know, what you do, people are going to say it sucks, right? You know what I'm saying? And you live in that sort of world where you just have people that are going to love you and people that are going to hate you. So I think that the haters serve a purpose. So, you know, I don't even think much about it.
Let me ask you this question. You're not going to get to where you get to. You said, what, you were upset because one year made, what was the number, 51 million? You said, I was upset because I didn't make a mil a week, 52. You said something like that, some scene or whatever it was. But let's just say, if you were to change two or three things for this to have lasted, what would those two or three things be? Like, did you think about that?
Sure,
you know, like,
course,
because I'm about to sit with Michael Francisi. He's one of the mafia families out of New York. He was a top guy. He was doing a lot of money himself. But the principles of what he teaches on building a business and corporation, it's absolutely insane. What you talk about in this book and the sales training that you offer yourself on the internet, anybody can learn from that and apply it. So if there was two or three adjustments, what would those things be?
Number one, for sure, would be the delaying the gratification. The biggest problem I had was
delaying the gratification.
Yeah, that's a problem that a lot of young entrepreneurs have. And I learned that the hard way, is that good things take time. And there were some moves I made that made me a lot of money in the short term, but then created problems for me over the long term. And for example, like Steve Madden Shoes is one of my companies, right?
I remember that. Yeah.
I was the majority shareholder of Steve Madden Shoes. If I had not had that problem from all the stuff I did earlier, I would have made $700 million, $1 billion
just
on that.
Just off of Steve Madden.
Just off of that one deal versus making $20, $30 million.
Got it.
Because I was forced to sell it too early, right? That's one example. And there's so many other examples just like that where, for instance, if I would have not gotten in trouble, I would have made the dot-com boom and been positioned to have the biggest firm out there during internet craze. I would have made it billions off of that. So while I made a little bit of extra money sooner, it cost me a lot more long-term by not playing that sort of long game, playing the short game. And I think that's a big mistake a lot of people make. And it's something that I learned really was crystallized when I wrote my first book, The Wolf of Wall Street, because that took me a year to write. I didn't make anything while I was writing it. I mean, I got some advances, very small,
sure,
right? And then, lo and behold, over years, it turned into this amazing thing that just spawned an entirely new life for me. So I think that it was a classic example of something that you work really hard on something and it pays off down the road. So I think it's one major thing is that. Second thing is that I think that a lot of young people, it's not because they're bad, or it's not about that, because I was a really good kid from a great family, never got in trouble.
You never got in trouble?
No. No, it was like, no, I never got, nothing like that at all. No, never got, went to jail, never.
I mean, your dad, from the way it was pictured, your dad was trying to protect you, right? A lot of accounting stuff.
I wasn't from that kind of family.
Yeah.
It was a really good family,
yeah,
right? Often you think when you're younger, or even when you're older, if you haven't had this lesson taught to you the hard way, is that I can be half pregnant when it comes to ethics. In other words, I can be ethical, but maybe I could step over the line once and get away with it.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that when you step over the ethical line once, your line of ethics moves a bit.
Mm.
So next time you step over, you'll step a bit further over
That's
the line.
That's such a good point.
Further. So with me, you know, I became desensitized to essentially right and wrong behavior. And it's very easy on Wall Street with a lot of people. As we found out in 2007, it wasn't just me, it was everyone.
Oh, even but 50 times bigger than what you were doing. Some of these guys cost a lot of people money.
The point is, I always say, everyone's doing it. That's no excuse for me doing it.
Sure.
I did what I did, it was wrong.
Yeah.
But the point was, it's very easy to point and say, well, everyone's doing it. So you have to...
That's such a good point.
You have to maintain your ethics. You really do. There's no...
How do you do that?
It's very simple. It really is very simple. You just don't take the first step.
Got it.
That's it. And that's the secret. There's no way you could take... You can't, like, just take a step and dabble it and be a good person.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard.
You think once you go in, it's harder to come out of it, like, to make a major shift out of it?
I don't think it's hard. I think it depends on how you were to start. In other words, if you were unethical your whole life...
Yeah.
Then that's who you are.
Got
For
it.
Me, I was an ethical person. I never had a problem before, and I never had a problem after. For me, it was very easy to find my ethical way because in my heart of hearts, that's who I was.
Wow.
So who you surround yourself with is going to impact you, and I really made some bad decisions in who I surrounded myself with. I just did. When people tell you you're the king, you're this, you're that, when I was 24, that was intoxicating. You know, all these young kids all looking up to me. I didn't handle that well. I thought you start to think that the normal rules don't apply to you. Which is why this time when all the success happened with the movie and all the speaking, it didn't affect me at all. Like it didn't.
You were used to it.
I knew it, with or without it, I was still who I was.
Right.
The first time around, you really started.
Is it also different because you had different people in your life, like your wife?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. For sure. It's a combination of those things. So, you know, it's who you associate with. It's understanding not to take the first step. And then people say, well, how do you know? Well, you know. You know, there's this feeling you get in your stomach. I think most, unless you're a sociopath, you know when you're not doing the right thing. You get this sort of feeling, maybe this, if you have that feeling, you're probably not doing the right thing, right? And then you have to be careful not to use the power of rationalization because the human brain is incredibly adept at rationalizing. So you got to avoid that. And, all in all, I think, for me, I'm fortunate that it ended up, I got a second chance, and that worked out really well. But for many people, you don't get.
That's right.
Don't put yourself behind the eight ball. Like, avoid that. You know, I don't mean don't fail. Fail. You should fail.
Sure.
Everyone should fail. I believe that. Fail. I learned more about when I failed than when I succeeded in business. Right. But going out there and losing your ethical way is a choice that you make. And I don't care if I'm not saying don't do drugs. I'm sober, but I'm not like don't do drugs. I'm talking about actions that impact other people negatively. You get it? That doesn't end well. And you really have to realize there is this sort of energy in the universe and there is karma and you want to be on the right side of that equation.
You know, the sales community it's a small community. Everybody, all the sales trainers, all the guys that are out there. I think you have, you know, like you see God use a guy like David. You know, David ends up becomes his favorite, but David made pretty much all the mistakes you can, and then boom, you know. I think there's an opportunity there for the younger generation to learn from you in a way that maybe somebody else is not going to be able to pass that down to them.
Sure, and that's what the good thing about the movie, because it created a platform for me, right?
That's right.
So that's what I take that seriously, which is why, like when you talk about things like Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. I know you want to talk about that, and you know that's why I've come out not against Bitcoin per se. I don't think Bitcoin's a scam. But there's scams being perpetrated around Bitcoin that are very dangerous for people that don't know better. And that's why I'm very concerned about it right now, because to the average person who's never been through this before, you know, you could very easily get caught up in something that's going to cost you all your money.
Have you invested yet?
No, not a penny.
Zero. Not Litecoin, not Bitcoin, not Ethereum, not none.
At this point, I can't, because ethically, I've come out heavily against it. And it will not be fixed. The only thing I would do is I would short futures. That would mean I'd have a financial axe to grind, which would make my opinion suspect. So I've decided to stay clear of the whole investment side of the equation. Instead, you know, I'm constantly going on all the TVs, CNN, Fox. They're all asking me to go on their shows, because I think I have a very unique purview into what's going on, because Bitcoin is so much like a penny stock. It's almost the perfect penny stock.
See, I remember penny stocks. As a broker, I was so excited about penny stocks.
You know, Bitcoin. Well, you know, Bitcoin is
same world.
The thing with Bitcoin is, you know, it's a wolf in sheep's clothing, so to speak, because it's supposed to be a currency, but no one uses it as a currency. It's an investment vehicle. So
let me ask you this. Let's look at both sides. Okay, let's say Bitcoin becomes what you say it is, which is it's a bubble. It's not going to work out. People lose $20 billion. Let's just say that goes away. Okay, but let's look at the other side. If it does become, hypothetically.
It won't, though.
But let's just say if it does.
It won't.
I understand that. But let's just say if we go in the direction where cryptocurrency is done by, let's just say, Goldman Sachs.
And I believe that will happen. That will happen.
That a Goldman's going to do it and they're going to control
will do it.
Somebody with a lot of credibility.
Absolutely.
If that 100%. Does happen, who gets hurt the most? What corporations, what industries get hurt the most?
It's the little people that get hurt.
That's you think the little people or the big banks?
No. People have this whole thing wrong. What's going on right now? This cryptocurrency. There's nothing different about cryptocurrency than any other currency. Listen, Bitcoin was started by some people that were not scam artists. They were not looking to break any laws. They were people that were almost like financial anarchists in a way, but there was a social experiment on alternative money.
Sure.
It's never going to be
young guys,
that.
By the way.
It's not going to be that. That's a naive way of looking at it. It's never going to happen. You actually think that the U.S. government and China and Japan and they're going to allow? There's just no way.
I'm on your side.
It won't happen. However, the technology itself is excellent. It's beautiful. It's elegant. Mm-hmm. And there's a place for that technology not just cryptocurrency, whether it's futures, anything that tracking investments through a blockchain technology is an elegant technology. It will never, ever be, besides the fact that there's fundamental problems with Bitcoin that will not allow it to ever really be used as a currency in mass. That's not the issue.
Saying that'll never happen as a mass?
No, I don't believe so, no.
So what do you think is gonna be? You think it's gonna be credit and cash? You don't think we'll be a cashless society?
No, I think that what's going to happen is that blockchain technology will be adopted, and one day, probably very soon, one of the big banks or a consortium of banks in conjunction with the government will have a cryptocurrency, but there's no different than regular currency. It's the same. Here's the thing about Bitcoin. As a currency, Bitcoin is no more useful at $20,000 than at $100. Yeah. It still works, whether it's $100 or $2 million, you could still use Bitcoin as a currency, right? It doesn't, because you could divide it up a million times. In other words, so the only reason it's running up is because it's not being used as a currency, it's being used for wild speculation. And what's happening is that there's two sides to every equation when you come to anything that's trading publicly. And that is, there's the market capitalization, which in Bitcoin, as we're saying, it's $200 billion some odd dollars, right? But that's irrelevant. All that matters when something is trading is what's called the float. How much is actually out there that's being bought and sold? Almost all of Bitcoin is locked away and is not trading. Mm-hmm. You have this $200 billion in market cap. There's probably $2 million, $10 million at the most trading of it. So when you have a very thin market cap like that, it's easy to manipulate it. And what happens is, once you buy Bitcoin, it's not so easy to sell it. it's a hassle to sell it. So it keeps getting thinner and thinner, which is why you have these wild swings. And then the latest thing, this latest joke of Bitcoin was this guy. I mean, I just saw something happen, which is he has a guy who's an insider in this Bitcoin thing, like exchange or something, right? And the guy is long massive amount of Bitcoin, rides up the wave, right? He sells his Bitcoin, and then he announces, after he sells it, he announces, I've sold all my Bitcoin, it's worthless, get out of Bitcoin, and I put everything into Bitcash. And guess what happens? Bitcash then runs up 100. Why do you think Bitcash is running up? This guy's got a lot of power. That's classic manipulating the market.
I mean, that happened in 1929 with Joseph Kennedy. Classic, this is nothing new.
It's classic manipulation. Yes. So it's because if this guy did not have a bad intent, you know what he would have done? He would have done that trade and shut up. What was the reason? Why would he say it publicly? I've sold all my Bitcoin, buy Bitcash. All he's looking to do is, it's a classic pump and dump.
So my question, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Whether or not they can solve some of the technical problems that plague Bitcoin. Long transaction times,
fees,
right? Everything,
all
the whole thing, right? It's not designed correctly for mass use, right? There's too much negative, there's too much damage done to powerful institutions and governments. They cannot let
it never happen. Well, let's go over there. Okay, let's go over there. So, you know, I parked my car outside. It said coins. I said, I don't have any coins. Who has coins nowadays? So I'm going to get a ticket. I said, it's okay. It's $75. I'll pay the ticket.
Well, most meters have these. You can use credit cards.
This one didn't have credit.
Yeah, it's so old-fashioned.
Yeah, okay. So no problem. California, I get it. So I come in and I'm thinking in my mind, what portion of the expenditure that you and I use today's coins? Probably 0.1%. Let's just say, if we process it that way. What percentage is cash? I don't think it's that high where it's cash. What percentage is credit? Let's say 80%, 90%. Yeah. Would you say that's around right there?
Okay.
You think Bitcoin will ever be a 5, 10, 20%?
No, it's not. I think you're completely off. In other words, forget Bitcoin. Bitcoin is never going anywhere, in my opinion, okay? Never. Blockchain technology, it'll be behind the scenes on your credit card. It'll be behind the scenes on your stock transfers. In other words, there's uses for blockchain technology and all these, it's a great technology. And it'll be behind the scenes, tracking things, making things cheaper.
Interesting.
But you'll still have all the financial institutions all clipping you anyway. They'll be using it to make their expenses lower, to make things more elegant around the world. But it's not gonna change anything.
Yeah, I heard you talk about Bitcoin and I said, man, I got like 6 or 7 more questions I wanna ask this guy. I want you to get deeper.
You know, I know I'm right, okay? Here's what I know. I promise you this, one day, in the not so distant future, all these young kids, they're gonna say, what the hell were we thinking? Like Bitcoin is 20,000, there's nothing. It's not,
it's almost like a joke. Yeah. My concern is not I'm going to put my money, like, you know how these guys say, by the way, think about Chamath. Chamath is the guy, I don't know if you know Chamath from Facebook, he's a part owner of Golden State. He's saying you put money in Bitcoin today, in the next 20 years, it's probably going to be $1 million, and the next 10 years, it's going to be $100,000. Like, that's what he's saying. Okay. Right. So you got your side.
He was never in the penny stock market, okay? He doesn't know what he's talking about.
I'm with you, but you got to realize the market, the best thing about the market is you got two opinions. Even with politics, you got left, you got right, you kind of hear them out. And weigh it out. There's a part that says that, there's a part that says it's gonna be $2, there's no difference between $2 or $20,000. That's not my argument. My argument is more my concern. Are we going in a direction where the banks, because if you think, you said central banks are not gonna give up control, because you look at political elections, a lot of times the person that controls the super delegates is the guy or the gal who has the money from the big bank. So I see Bitcoin's biggest enemy being banks, politicians and the government that may come in and say, I'm not going to give them that much control to you.
Listen, the government, the biggest thing that the government is worried about, all crimes, you know what the one thing they hate more than anything? Money laundering. You actually think...
That's a question we have to answer, Series 7.
You actually think that you're going to allow this technology to run rampant where everyone can launder money and... It's never going to... Not even a freaking possibility, okay? Why do you think that Bitcoin is constantly being plagued by scams? Why is it? The people who did it weren't scam. The guys who founded it were not scam artists. They weren't. They were legitimate guys that were doing an experiment.
Sure.
And they had a good idea, right?
Yep.
This technology is flawed. It's flawed in the sense that it opens itself up to be manipulated. It's like the perfect storm for manipulation. In the 1980s, we had things called blind pools. Remember blind pools? Mm-hmm. Blind pools were the biggest scam ever. And that's what all of these coins are. They're blind pools where you raise money and you issue paper, which is big, and it's a limited amount, right? And so it's finite. And then with blind pools, you would say, One day we'll figure out we're gonna buy something with the money. Well, with this, we're not even buying anything, right? But the point is money's being raised, you're creating value, and there's nothing behind it. All you're doing is running on scarcity. That model is not gonna last.
You're putting this in that category?
Oh, it's even worse though.
Would you say it's the same as credit swaps as well, like similar to what happened with the mortgage?
Well, there's a woman who's behind this whole thing also. The girl who founded, I forgot her name, the woman who was one of the primary designers of credit swaps is now trying to get Bitcoin used for the same thing because she doesn't care.
So you put them in the same pool?
Well, it's not the same pool, it's very different. In other words, Bitcoin is what you're doing is that you're taking something. The scam that's going on right now is something was designed to be used as a currency, and it's being used as an investment vehicle. That's what's going on. Okay, there is no real currency going on. It's like this tiny for Bitcoin. For all the action in Bitcoin around the world, what do you think is really being used as a currency? Like virtually nothing. So it's a wolf in sheep's clothing. They're saying it's a currency. It's not being used as a currency. It's not particularly well suited as a currency for all the reasons we already spoke about. And now they say, well, the Bitcoin Cash is better. Bottom line is this, okay? When this thing is adopted, it'll be by governments in the mainstream, and these people, a lot of them will end up in jail. The ones who
you think they'll end up not the founders. You're talking about the guys that are manipulating
the guys
market.
That are manipulating the stuff. The guys that are doing the wrong stuff. They end up in jail. Okay, and the investors. What's going to happen with Bitcoin is going to be a black swan event in the next 6 months. I'm not saying Bitcoin's going down. It might go to 50,000. I wouldn't short Bitcoin for a second right now. I don't know where it's going over the short. I know where it's going over the long term.
Well, you're on the outside. You're just kind of looking to see what's
going
to do.
I'm not saying it's going down. Most of the interviews I said I think it's going up. Now I'm not so sure right now because the insiders now I see a classic pump and dump happening right now where they're already on the dump on Bitcoin going into the next one, which is Bitcash, right? So I see that happening. So let's see. The only way Bitcoin is going up is if someone's got an axe to grind. If there are people out there wanting to manipulate it, it'll go higher. Otherwise, it could be close to the end. Remember this, with Tulip Mania, the beginning of the end was when they started trading futures in tulips. That was it. Once they started trading, it over 6 months later, right? So people look at this, they're trading futures, yay! Like, it's legitimate. No, it's not. The people that are trading legitimate are no more than the credit fault. So it's just, it's a complete joke. Nothing is guaranteed in life, okay? I have never been more sure of something, okay? That this ends really, really badly for people.
That's great.
I'm not saying don't invest in it now, but be really, really careful. Make sure that you have a way out really quickly, okay? Don't put in more than you can afford to lose. And just realize that you are on the outside looking in of people who are on the inside who have a plan that you don't know about, and all you're doing is trying to guess when they're going to screw you.
My concern is these guys are putting 50, 60, 70% of their savings into and thinking this is their way out. Like, here's how I'm going to become a decamillionaire.
And they might become one if they can figure out when to get out. The point is that, bulls make money, bears make money, pigs get slaughtered, right? And the question is when are you going to get out? And because at a certain point of game, of time, the music's going to stop playing, and there's not going to be enough chairs for everybody.
Yeah.
In fact, there'll be very few chairs at all. It might be one chair, and everyone else is going to get. And here's the thing: when this thing really goes, if it's at 30,000, it's not going from 30,000 to 29,000 to 28,000. It's going from 30,000 to one.
That's right.
With one trade. It'll just stop trading. It'll open up at 1,600. Next trade, 400. Gone.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen.
Yeah. I remember when eToys went from 75 bucks to a penny due to the gifts not showing up on time during Christmas 15, 17 years ago when eToys just went, boom, 75 to a penny and nobody expected it.
If you want to trade this thing right now, you're far better off getting involved in one of the other cryptocurrencies than Bitcoin right now. But listen, I don't even want to say this because there's obviously ways to make money in this. I refuse to do it. I will not get involved in this because it's all manipulated. But obviously you can make a lot of money when things, if you know how to write a manipulation, you got to get in right. You got to get in before the manipulation is done, And I really can't advise people to do that. But, if you knew the people that look at Bitcash, if you knew the people who were manipulating it, then all you got to do is be in line with them and you make a ton of money.
That's right. So then, but that's a whole different insider part that you're going to be dealing with. So. Okay, cool. So that's plenty with Bitcoin here. Appreciate your thoughts. Let's talk sales management. I mean, you're a beast when it comes down to sales. It was fascinating when you're talking about your 1, 2, 3, your sales training that you have with people, you know, certainty, is it 10, is it this, is it that? Yeah. What I want to talk to you about is, you recruit me. I'm a new sales guy. I'm working for you. One, what do you look for somebody to be a good candidate for you?
Well, it depends on the industry. It depends on what they're selling. I mean, you know, in some industries, you want to hire someone that has some experience. In other industries, you don't. It's better to have someone that has no experience. So you really can't answer that question blanket without having some context to it. But, you know, there are certain personality types that tend to do better at selling. At Stratton back in the day, it was, I don't care. I don't want anyone who knows anything about stocks. It's so easy for me to train someone to become a salesman. So the skill of selling is a very easy skill set to acquire, right? When someone that knows how to teach you the straight line, it's very easy to learn. More importantly is does someone have a standard that is gonna demand them to make a lot of money? In other words, what's that person's financial state? I want hungry people that really just wanna make a lot of money. And I want people who obviously are gonna represent my product the right way. I don't want a bunch of, you know, people who are not gonna go out there and serve the brand. In some industries, like, I would never wanna hire someone without industry experience because it's so crucial to be able to speak a certain way in the industry, right? Other times I wanna hire some people that have connections already. They might have sold us, they already know the decision makers, right? And I want someone that can kind of walk in the door with a new product and hire that person. So it all depends on the situation.
Are there, no matter what's for you, like, were there, and maybe then and now, you know, your experience, are there things that you say, if this guy can't do this, 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 you're not gonna make it in sales?
If someone can't take rejection, that's obviously, you know, a red flag. But I think a lot of time that is more of a symptom of a different problem, that they don't know how to sell. In other words, my experience with people that have problems taking rejection is once you teach them how to sell, they don't have a problem taking rejection because they understand what it's about and how to handle it. I look for someone who's has desire, they're hungry, willing to learn. Team players, obviously. I love people that want to work on commission. So if someone says they need a huge salary up front and they don't really want, that's a huge red flag, no commission, right? I love commission-based people. And I've probably recruited and trained more salesmen than probably anyone on the planet, tens of thousands of them, right? And sometimes it's just hard to know. Really, it is hard to know.
That's
we have
so
tests.
True.
I have some company that developed tests based on my personality type, like, you know, psychometric tests for sales. So you can run a psychometric test on people. So much of it comes down to what happens when the person gets hired. Is there an induction? Like, you know, having the right induction program to get someone indoctrinated into the cult, so to speak, of the product,
sure,
or the company. And then also, you know, training them. This is the biggest mistake that most companies make. Two things. A, they don't provide people with the sales training they need to make them expert closing, technically know how to close the deal. So they don't go into good situations and blow them, right? And the second thing is many companies don't invest enough in the marketing side of the equation to provide leads to the salespeople. It's a big thing. I can't tell you how many, I get hired all the time to go to companies to train the sales forces. And at least 75% of the time, they also need help in the marketing category. They're not giving the salesman the support they need by giving them leads. Leads are the gasoline in the engine of a salesman. So it's that too.
Got it. Jordan, how much do you think sales has changed from the times you were selling to today?
Not much at all. I mean, people think that it has. I don't think it's changed really at all. What makes someone say yes has not changed. It's still the same things, the same elements of, you know, of sales need to line up in someone's mind before they say yes. What has changed is that there's different ways that we communicate with people right now. For instance, like, you know, you have email, which is a big thing, landing pages and conversions, and so that gets lumped into marketing, but it's really sales. It's sort of marketing and sales in one spot, right? When it really comes down to it, someone's got to sell someone something.
No doubt.
Like, look at Amazon. You say, well, they don't sell. Yes, they do. Their processes, they are so elegant at what they do that they've got it down to like one click, because they realize that every time someone's going to make a second action, the response rate goes down, right? You know, they're using all the principles of marketing and sales and everything they do. And also, how do you think Jeff Bezos recruited all the people? He had to sell them to come and join Amazon. How did he sell Wall Street to believe in? So there's always salespeople involved. Like, you know, Jeff Bezos is the most amazing salesperson. He sold the concept to everybody.
$100 billion guy.
So when people look at sales, it's very, very linear. Like, I'm a salesman, or everyone's a salesperson.
Sure.
The way we get leads has changed very much, very much.
Social media.
Yeah, that's changed, no doubt. How you go out getting leads. But when someone walks in the door, you pick up a telephone, and it's going to be the same stuff. And people are just smarter now because they have smartphones to look at. So you have to be, you know, more logic based. You can't just be all full of shit, basically, right, as a salesman. So
I want to ask one last question on the sales side. For the sales managers out there, people who are running a sales team, they're running a sales organization, what advice can you give to a sales manager to become a business? So I've been in sales, I'm selling, I'm making six figures, maybe I'm at a quarter million, maybe I'm making a $500,000 a year income. How do I become a better sales manager? What would you say?
Well, number one is there are certain very basic principles that a lot of sales managers don't really adhere to. Number one is very often I'll go into a company and I'll see that they've instituted a flawed compensation structure, where the compensation structure itself doesn't get the most out of salespeople.
Wow.
It allows them to sort of work hard for a while, they get lazy and work off residuals. So
we just talked about that. Yeah.
So that's one clear thing I see all over is compensation structures that are not structured correctly that lead to laziness and salesmen to sit back and sort of collect royalties or trailing income, right? That's one thing. Another thing is that I think that many sales managers don't do even close to enough sales training. They don't make sure, if every sales force that I've ever managed, I made sure they were great salespeople. Number three is giving frequent meetings. In other words, motivation, you know, what you say to people every once in a while doesn't have that much impact. What you say to them every day has massive impact.
Isn't that amazing?
You gotta give meetings all the time and keep in people's ears. And, you know, it's like there's a greater purpose for the company. And that only comes from constant communication. And those are just three things that definitely, you know, that I see a massive holes I see in many sales forces.
So number one, comp. Number two, sales training. Number three, motivation and constant communication. So what is Jordan up to nowadays? I mean, you know, you've gone through what you're doing. You have a movie now. Everybody wants you to be out there. And so it's interesting. You're telling me you're speaking in Tehran, Iran. That's absolutely unbelievable.
I say, after this movie, I used to kid around and say, well, the household name except everywhere but Iran and North Korea. I guess I was wrong. It's only North Korea now, you know? So apparently they love the movie in Iran. I didn't know that. And So listen, I mean, for me right now, it's a new year coming up, right? And my wife and I have been deciding what we want to do. We're in a good spot, thankfully. We have some breathing room to make decisions. And, you know, and I think that there's something really, really awesome. There's an awesome thing right now, an opportunity I have, and that is that there's probably hundreds of millions of people out there in the age groups that are 18 to 30, 25, 30. And what's happening is people grow up with this movie. And every year the audience gets bigger because they watch the movie. They start to graduate college, right? And something I really want to do is really help unify this group of people and make sure they don't get screwed by things like Bitcoin or making the mistakes that I made. I think there's so many things I did really well and so many things I did really poorly. That I like almost the best and the worst. So I think I really represent a person that can help serve as sort of a beacon of light for people to succeed in life. And I want to really start connecting with far more. I've spoken to millions of people around the world, but I think I want to start really doing a lot more stuff online about my own TV show, a radio show online. We'll see. So I'm looking at that stuff.
That's exciting. Let's talk about your book, man. Yeah. Really a cool book where you get right into it. And you said for 10 years, I didn't want to write a book. And you said, you know, you don't write a book to make your money. You write a book because you really want to share this with the audience. And you are actually, I was reading it initially. I was expecting it to be just a lot of story based. You're getting right into it. You're not even hesitating. You're getting right into it saying, here's how you do this. Here's what I did here. Here's the key to this here. And it's a very duplicatable manner of the way you're teaching, which I was very impressed.
Yeah, this book, I wrote this book to help people. I didn't write to make money. I didn't care about the money. I mean, there's better ways to make money than writing books. And I wrote this myself. It wasn't a ghostwriter.
Yeah, so you talked about that.
It took years to do, right? I wanted this to be like a book that I didn't care how many copies it sold the first year. I wanted it to be like a Think and Grow Rich that would be around for 100 years. And I really believe it's going to be that. I think this book is just going to keep selling and growing and becoming more and more a staple of every person. It's like a must. I think it should be a must read for every human being, because what it really is, it's a communication strategy. That's what the straight lines of communication strategy shows you, how to communicate, how to share your ideas, your concepts. It doesn't matter whether you're in sales or not. It just shows you how to be a more effective human being. And I just couldn't imagine going through life. So many people who go through life and they have great ideas, right? Brilliant ideas. They have so much to give the world, They have so much to provide for their family. They could be rich. But because they lack the ability to communicate in an effective way, they die with their music on their lips. They can't express their greatness.
Wow.
That's a skill you have to have if you want to be a success-oriented individual. You need to learn how to communicate your hopes, your ideas, your dreams in a way that connects with people and moves them to take action, gets you what you want to. That's what ethical persuasion is all about.
Yeah, so for anybody that's watching this, I would tell you, for me, here's how I read books. I read a book first myself, then I buy a copy for every one of my sales guys, and I have them read it, and I ask them to write a paper on it, and I want to find out what you get out of it. We've been running a book club for many, many years, and I think it's so interesting. I'm so surprised, Jordan, at how few sales teams run a book club. Guys, go get this book. Read the book. If you got a sales team, buy it for every one of your sales guys and have them read it and post a review on Amazon. Follow Jordan. I think, Jordan, you're on pretty much every social media platform.
Yeah.
Twitter, Instagram, everything. Again, brother, thank you so much for your time, man. Really enjoyed it. Great conversation.
Thanks,
everybody, for listening. And by the way, if you haven't already subscribed to Valuetainment on iTunes, please do so. Give us a 5-star. Write a review if you haven't already. And if you have any questions for me that you may have, you can always find me on Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Just search my name, Patrick Bit-David. And I actually do respond back when you snap me or send me a message on Instagram. With that being said, have a great day today. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.